Blood price. As Aragorn made his way down a flight of steps, on his way toward the main entrance of the building, he happened upon the herbalist Angela, sitting cross-legged in the dark alcove of a door. She was knitting what appeared to be a blue and white hat, with strange runes along its lower part, the meaning of which was lost on him. Next to her lay Solemnbum, his head propped up in her lap, and one of his heavy paws resting atop her right knee. Aragorn stopped, surprised. He had not seen either of them since... It took him a moment to remember, since shortly after the battle in Urabain. Thereafter they had seemed to disappear. "Greetings," said Angela, without looking up. "Greetings," replied Aragorn. "What are you doing here?"
"Knitting a hat."
"That I can see. But why here?"
"Because I wanted to see you."
Her needles clacked with swift regularity, their motion as entrancing as the flames of a fire.
"I heard tell that you, Saphira, the Eggs and the Eldenari, are leaving Alagazia."
"As you predicted," he retorted, frustrated that she had been able to discover what ought to have been the deepest secret. She could not have eavesdropped upon him and Nasawada. His wards would have prevented it. And so far as he knew, no one had told her or Solemnbum about the existence of the Eggs or the Eldenari.
"Well, yes, but I didn't think to see you off."
"How did you find out? From Arya?"
"Her? Ha! Hardly. No, I had my own ways of gathering information."
She paused in her knitting and looked up at him, her eyes twinkling.
"Not that I'll share them with you. I have to keep some secrets, after all."
"Humph.
Humph yourself. If you're going to be that way, I'm not sure why I bother coming."
"I'm sorry. I'm just feeling a bit uneasy." After a moment, Aragorn said, "Why did you want to see me?"
"I wanted to say farewell, and to wish you luck on your journey."
"Thank you."
"Hmm.
Try not to let yourself get too wrapped up in your head, wherever you settle. Make sure you get out in the sun often enough."
"I will.
What of you and Solemnbum? Will you stay here for a while and watch over Elva? You mentioned you would." The herbalist snorted in a very unladylike fashion.
"Stay? How can I stay, when Nasawada seems intent on spying on every magician in the land?"
"You heard about that as well?"
She gave him a look. "I disapprove. I disapprove very much. I will not be treated like a child who has done something naughty. No, the time has come for Solemnbum and me to relocate to more friendly climes. The Beor Mountains, perhaps, or do Welden Varden."
Aragorn hesitated for a moment, and then said, "Would you like to come with Saphira and me?" Solemnbum opened one eye and studied him for a second before closing it again.
"That's very kind of you," said Angela, "but I think we will decline, at least for the time being. Sitting around guarding the Eldunari and training new riders seems boring, although raising a clutch of dragons is sure to prove exciting. But no, for the time being, Solemnbum and I will stay in Alagazia. Besides, I want to keep an eye on Elva for the next few years, even if I can't watch over her in person.
Haven't you had your fill of interesting events?"
"Never. They're the spice of life."
She held up her half-finished hat.
"How do you like it?"
"It's nice. The blue is pretty.
But what do the runes say?"
"Raxacora..."
"Oh, never mind. It wouldn't mean anything to you anyway.
Safe travels to you and Saphira, Aragorn.
And remember to watch out for earwigs and wild hamsters. Ferocious things, wild hamsters."
He smiled, despite himself.
"Safe travels to you as well. And to you, Solemnbum."
The weercat's eye opened again.
"Safe travels, Kingkiller."
Aragorn left the building and picked his way through the city until he arrived at the house where Jode and his wife Helen now lived. It was a stately hall, with high walls, a large garden, and bowing servants stationed within the entryway. Helen had done exceedingly well. By provisioning the Varden, and now Nasawada's kingdom, with much-needed supplies. She had quickly built up a trading company larger than the one Jode had once owned in Tiem. Aragorn found Jode, washing up in preparation for their evening meal. After refusing an offer to dine with them, Aragorn spent a few minutes explaining to Jode the same things he had explained to Nasawada. At first, Jode was surprised and somewhat upset, but in the end, he agreed that it was necessary for Aragorn and Saphira to leave with the other dragons. As with Nasawada and the herbalist, Aragorn also invited Jode to accompany them. "You tempt me sorely," said Jode, "but my place is here. I have my work, and for the first time in a long while, Helen is happy. Illyria has become our home, and neither of us wants to pick up and move elsewhere." Aragorn nodded, understanding. "But you, you're going to travel where few but the dragons or riders have ever gone. Tell me, do you know what lies to the east? Is there another sea? If you travel far enough. And before that?" Aragorn shrugged. "Empty land for the most part, or so the Eldonari say, and I have no reason to think that's changed in the past century." Then Jode moved closer to him and lowered his voice. "Since you are leaving, I will tell you this. Do you remember when I told you about the Arcana, the order devoted to preserving knowledge throughout Alagesia?" Aragorn nodded. "You said that Heslant the Monk belonged to them. As do I." At Aragorn's look of surprise, Jode made a sheepish gesture and ran his hand through his hair. "I joined them long ago, when I was young and looking for a cause to serve. I've provided them with information and manuscripts throughout the years, and they've helped me in return. Anyway, I thought you should know. Brom was the only other person I've told." "Not even Helen?" "Not even her. Anyway, when I finish writing my account of you and Saphira and the rise of the Varden, I'll send it to our monastery in the Spine, and it will be included as a number of new chapters in Domia Aberwyrda. Your story will not be forgotten, Aragorn. That much, at least, I can promise you."
Aragorn found the knowledge strangely affecting.
"Thank you," he said, and grasped Jode by the forearm. "And you, Aragorn Shadeslayer?"
Afterward, Aragorn made his way back to the hall where he and Saphira had been living along with Roran and Katrina, who were waiting to eat with him. All through supper, the talk was of Arya and Thirnan. Aragorn held his tongue about his plans for departure until after the food was gone, and the three of them and the baby had retired to a room overlooking the courtyard, where Saphira lay napping with Thirnan. There they sat drinking wine and tea and watching as the sun descended toward the distant horizon. When an appropriate amount of time had passed, Aragorn broached the subject. As he expected, Katrina and Roran reacted with dismay and tried to convince him to change his mind. It took Aragorn nearly an hour to lay out his reasons to them, for they argued every point and refused to concede until he answered their objections in exacting detail. Finally, Roran said,
"Blast it, your family! You can't leave!"
"I have to. You know it as well as I do. You just don't want to admit it."
Roran struck his fist against the table between them and then strode over to the open window, the muscles in his jaw clenching. The baby squalled, and Katrina said, "Shh, now," and patted her on the back. Aragorn joined Roran.
"I know it isn't what you want. I don't want it either, but I have no choice."
"Of course you have a choice. You, of all people, have a choice."
"Aye, and this is the right thing to do."
Roran grunted and crossed his arms.
Behind them, Katrina said, "If you leave, you won't be able to be an uncle to Ysmira. Is she supposed to grow up without ever knowing you?"
"No," said Aragorn, going back to her.
"I'll still be able to talk with her, and I'll see to it that she's well protected. I may even be able to send her presents from time to time."
He knelt and held out a finger,
and the girl wrapped her hand around it and tugged with precocious strength. But you won't be here. No, I won't be here. Aragorn gently extricated his finger from his mirror's grip and returned to stand by Roran. As I said, you could join me. The muscles in Roran's jaw shifted. And give up Palancar Valley? He shook his head. Horst and the others are already preparing to return. We'll rebuild Carvajal as the finest town in the whole spine. You could help. It would be like before. I wish I could. Below, Saphira uttered a throaty gurgle and nuzzled the side of Fiernan's neck. The green dragon snuggled closer to her. In a low voice, Roran said, Is there no other way, Aragorn? Not that Saphira or I can think of.
Blast it! It's not right! You shouldn't have to go live by yourself in the wilderness!
I won't be entirely alone. Blodgarm and a few other elves will be going with us. Roran made an impatient gesture.
You know what I mean!
He gnawed on the corner of his mustache and leaned on his hands against the stone lip underneath the window. Aragorn could see the sinews in his thick forearms knotting and flexing. Then Roran looked at him and said,
What will you do once you get to wherever you're going?
Find a hill or a cliff and build a hall atop it, a hall large enough to house all the dragons and keep them safe. And you? Once you rebuild the village, what then? A faint smile appeared on Roran's face.
Something similar. With the tribute from the valley, I plan to build a castle atop that hill we always talked about. Not a big castle, mind you. Just a bit of stonework with a wall. Enough to hold off any Urgals who might decide to attack. It'll probably take a few years, but then we'll have a proper way to defend ourselves. Unlike when the Razak came with the soldiers. He cast a sideways glance at Aragorn. We'd have room for a dragon as well.
Would you have room for two dragons? Aragorn gestured towards Saphira and Fiernan.
Maybe not. How does Saphira feel about having to leave him?
She doesn't like it, but she knows it's necessary. The amber light from the dying sun accentuated the planes of Roran's face. Somewhat to Aragorn's surprise, he saw the beginnings of lines and wrinkles on his cousin's brow and around his eyes. He found the signs of encroaching age sobering. How quickly life passes. Katrina laid Ismira in a cradle. Then she joined them at the window and placed a hand on Aragorn's shoulder. We'll miss you, Aragorn. And I you, he said, and touched her hand. We don't have to say goodbye quite yet, though. I'd like the three of you to come with us to Ellesmira. You would enjoy seeing it, I think. And that way we could spend another few days together. Roran swiveled his head toward Aragorn. We can't travel all the way to do Weldenvarden with Ismira. She's too young.
Returning to Palancar Valley is going to be difficult enough. A side trip to Ellesmira is out of the question.
Not even if it was on Dragonback? Aragorn laughed at their surprised expressions. Arya and Fiernan have agreed to carry you to Ellesmira, while Saphira and I fetched the dragon eggs from where they're hidden.
How long would the flight to Ellesmira take? Asked Roran, frowning.
A week or so. Arya intends to visit King Oric in Trondheim on the way. You'd be warm and safe the whole while. Ismira wouldn't be in any danger.
Katrina looked at Roran, and he at her, and she said,
It would be nice to see Aragorn off, and I've always heard tell of how beautiful the elf cities are.
Are you sure you would be up to it? Asked Roran.
She nodded. As long as you're there with us.
Roran was silent for a moment. Then he said,
Well, I suppose Horst and the others can go on ahead without us.
A smile appeared under his beard, and he chuckled.
I never thought to see the Beor Mountains, or to stand in one of the elf cities. But why not, eh? We might as well while we have the chance.
Good. That's settled then, said Katrina, beaming. We're going to do Weldenvarden.
How will we get back? Asked Roran.
On Fiernan, said Aragorn. Or I'm sure Arya would give you guards to escort you to Palancar Valley, if you would prefer to travel by horse.
Roran grimaced. No, not by horse. If I never have to ride another horse in my life, it would be too soon by half.
Oh, then I take it you don't want Snowfire any more? Said Aragorn, raising an eyebrow as he named the stallion he had given Roran.
You know what I mean. I'm glad to have Snowfire, even if I haven't had need of him for a while.
Mm-hmm. They stood by the window for another hour or so, as the sun set, and the sky turned purple and then black, and the stars came out, planning their upcoming trip, and discussing the things Aragorn and Saphira would need to take with them when they left Duweldenvarden for the lands beyond. Behind them, Ismira slept peacefully in her cradle, her hands balled up in tiny fists beneath her chin. Early the next morning, Aragorn used the polished silver mirror in his room to contact Oric in Trondheim. He had to wait for a few minutes, but eventually Oric's face appeared before him, the dwarf running an ivory comb through his unbraided beard.
Aragorn! Oric exclaimed with obvious delight. How are you? It's been too long since last we spoke.
Feeling a bit guilty, Aragorn agreed. Then he told Oric of his decision to leave, and the reasons why. Oric stopped combing and listened without interrupting, his expression serious throughout. When Aragorn finished, Oric said,
I will be sad to see you go, but I agree, this is what you must do. I have thought about this myself, worried about where the dragons might live. But I keep my concerns to myself, for the dragons have as much right to share the land as we do. Even if we do not like it when they eat our Feldenost and burn our villages. However, raising them elsewhere will be for the best.
I'm glad you approve, said Aragorn. He talked to Oric about his idea for the Urgles then, which involved the dwarves as well. This time Oric asked many questions, and Aragorn could see that he was doubtful about the proposal. After a long silence, wherein Oric stared down into his beard, the dwarf said,
If you had asked this of any of the Grindstonsburthen before me, they would have said no. Had you asked me at any time before we invaded the Empire, I would also have said no. But now, after having fought alongside the Urgles, and after having seen in person how helpless we were before Murtagh and Thorn, and Galbatorix and that monster Shrukan, now I no longer feel the same.
He gazed up through his bushy eyebrows at Aragorn.
It may cost me mine crown, but on behalf of Nurlan everywhere, I will accept, for their own good, whether or not they realize it.
Again, Aragorn felt proud to have Oric as his foster brother. Thank you, he said. Oric grunted.
My people never desired this, but I am grateful for it. When will we know?
Within a few days, a week at most.
Will we feel anything?
Maybe. I'll ask Arya. Either way, I'll contact you again once it's done.
Good. Then we will speak later. Safe travels and sound stone, Aragorn.
May Helsvog watch over you. The following day, they departed Illyria. It was a private event, devoid of fanfare, for which Aragorn was grateful. Nasawada, Jormunda, Jod, and Elva met them outside the city's southern gate, where Saphira and Fearnan sat side by side, pushing their heads against one another, while Aragorn and Arya inspected their saddles. Roran and Katrina arrived a few minutes later, Katrina carrying Ismira swaddled in a blanket, and Roran carrying two packs full of blankets, food, and other supplies, one slung over each shoulder. Roran gave his packs to Arya, and she tied them atop Fionn's saddlebags. Then Aragorn and Saphira said their last farewells, which was harder for Aragorn than for Saphira. His were not the only eyes with tears, however. Both Nasawada and Jod wept as they embraced him and offered him and Saphira their good wishes. Nasawada also said farewell to Roran, and she again thanked him for his help against the Empire. At last, as Aragorn, Arya, Roran, and Katrina were about to climb onto the dragons, a woman called out,
"Hold there!"
Aragorn paused with his foot atop Saphira's right foreleg and looked to see Birgit striding toward them from the city gates, grey skirts billowing, and her young son, Nolfavrel, trailing after her, with a helpless expression on his face. In one hand, Birgit carried a drawn sword, in the other, a round wooden shield. Aragorn's stomach sank. Nasawada's guards moved to intercept the two of them, but Roran shouted, "Let them pass!" Nasawada signalled to the guards, and they stepped aside. Without slowing, Birgit walked over to Roran.
"Birgit, please don't," said Katrina in a low voice,
but the other woman ignored her. Arya watched them unblinkingly, her hand on her sword.
"Stronghammer, I always said that I would have my compensation from you for my husband's death, and now I have come to claim it, as is my right. Will you fight me, or will you pay the debt that is yours?"
Aragorn went to stand by Roran.
"Birgit, why are you doing this? Why now? Can't you forgive him and let old sorrows rest?"
"Do you want me to eat her?"
asked Saphira.
"Not yet."
Birgit ignored him and kept her gaze fixed on Roran.
"Mother,"
said Nolfavrel, tugging on her skirts. But she showed no reaction to his plea. Nasawada joined them.
"I know you," she said to Birgit. "You fought with the men during the war."
"Yes, your majesty."
"What quarrel have you with Roran? He has proved himself a fine and valuable warrior on more than one occasion, and I would be most displeased to lose him. He and his family were responsible for the soldiers killing my husband."
She looked at Nasawada for a moment.
"The Razak ate him, your majesty. They ate him, and they sucked the marrow from his bones. I cannot forgive that, and I will have my compensation for it."
"It was not Roland's fault," said Nasawada. "This is unreasonable, and I forbid it."
"No, it's not," said Aragorn, though he hated to. "By our custom, she has the right to demand a blood price from everyone who was responsible for Quimby's death."
"But it wasn't Roran's fault," exclaimed Katrina.
"But it was," said Roran in a low voice. "I could have turned myself over to the soldiers. I could have led them away, or I could have attacked. But I didn't. I chose to hide, and Quimby died as a result." He glanced at Nasawada. "This is a matter we must settle among ourselves, your majesty. It is a matter of honour, even as the trial of the Long Knives was for you."
Nasawada frowned and looked to Aragorn. He nodded. So with reluctance, she stepped back.
"What will it be, Stronghammer?"
asked Birgit.
"Aragorn and I killed the Razak in Hellgrind," said Roran.
"Is that not enough?"
Birgit shook her head, her determination never wavering.
"No."
Roran paused then, the muscles in his neck rigid.
"Is this what you really want, Birgit?"
"It is."
"Then I will pay my debt."
As Roran spoke, Katrina uttered a wail and thrust herself between him and Birgit, still holding their daughter in her arms.
"I won't let you. You can't have him, not now. Not after everything we've gone through."
Birgit's face remained as stone, and she made no move to retreat. Likewise, Roran showed no emotion as he grasped Katrina by the waist and, without apparent effort, lifted her off to the side.
"Hold her, would you?"
he said to Aragorn in a cold voice.
"Roran."
His cousin gave him a flat stare, then turned back to Birgit. Aragorn grabbed hold of Katrina's shoulders to keep her from flinging herself after Roran, and he exchanged a helpless look with Arya. She glanced toward her sword, and he shook his head.
"Let go of me! Let go!"
shouted Katrina. In her arms, the baby began to scream. Never taking his eyes off the woman before him, Roran undid his belt and dropped it to the ground, along with his dagger and his hammer, which one of the Varden had found in the streets of Illyria soon after Galbatorix's death. Then Roran pulled open the front of his tunic and bared his hair-covered chest. "Aragorn, remove my wards," he said.
"I remove them."
"Roran, no!" shouted Katrina. "Defend yourself!"
"He's mad," thought Aragorn, but he dared not interfere. If he stopped Birgit, he would shame Rohan, and the people of Palancar Valley would lose all respect for his cousin. And Rohan, Aragorn knew, would rather die than allow that to happen. Nevertheless, Aragorn had no intention of letting Birgit kill Rohan. He would let her have her price, but no more, speaking softly in the ancient language, so that none might hear the words he used. He did as Rohan had asked, but he also placed 3 new wards upon his cousin, one to protect the spine within his neck from being severed, one to keep his skull from being broken, and one to safeguard his organs. All else, Aragorn felt confident he could heal if necessary, as long as Birgit did not start cutting off limbs. "It is done," he said. Rohan nodded, and to Birgit said, "Take your price of me, then, and let this be an end to the quarrel between us."
"You will not fight me?"
"No." Birgit eyed him for a moment. Then she threw her shield onto the ground, crossed the few remaining feet that separated her from Rohan, and placed the edge of her sword against Rohan's breast. In a voice loud enough for only Rohan to hear, though Aragorn and Arya did as well, with their cat-like acuity, she said,
"I loved Quimby. He was my life. And he died because of you."
"I'm sorry," Rohan whispered.
"Birgit," pleaded Katrina, "please."
No one moved, not even the dragons. Aragorn found himself holding his breath. The hiccuping crying of the baby was the loudest sound. Then Birgit lifted the sword from Rohan's breast. She reached down to take his right hand and drew the edge of the sword across his palm. Rohan winced as the blade cut into his hand, but he did not pull away. A crimson line appeared upon his skin. Blood filled his palm and spilled dripping to the ground, where it soaked into the trampled earth, leaving a dark blotch upon the dirt. Birgit ceased pulling on the sword and held it motionless against Rohan's palm for a moment more. Then she stepped back and lowered the scarlet-edged sword to her side. Rohan closed his fingers around his palm, blood flowing between them, and pressed his hand against his hip.
"I have had my price," said Birgit. "Our quarrel is at an end."
Then she turned, picked up her shield, and strode back to the city, with Nolf Avrel dogging her heels. Aragorn released Katrina, and she rushed to Rohan's side.
"You fool," she said, a bitter note in her voice. "You stubborn, pig-headed fool! Here, let me see."
"It was the only way," said Rohan, as if from far away. Katrina frowned, her face hard and strained as she examined the cut on his hand.
"Aragorn, you should heal this."
"No," said Rohan with sudden sharpness. He closed his hand again. "No, this is one scar I'll keep." He looked around. "Is there a strip of fabric I can use as a bandage?" After a moment of confusion, Nasawada pointed to one of her guards and said,
"Cut off the bottom part of your tunic and give it to him."
"Wait," said Aragorn, as Rohan started to wrap the strip around his hand.
"I won't heal it, but at least let me cast a spell to keep the cut from getting infected. All right?"
Rohan hesitated, then he nodded and held out his hand toward Aragorn. It took Aragorn only a few seconds to mouth the spell.
"There," he said. "Now it won't turn green and purple and swell up as large as a pig's bladder."
Rohan grunted, and Katrina said,
"Thank you, Aragorn. Now, shall we leave?"
asked Arya. The 5 of them climbed onto the dragons, Arya helping Rohan and Katrina safely into the saddle on Fiernan's back, which had been modified with loops and straps to hold additional passengers. Once they were properly seated atop the green dragon, Arya raised a hand.
"Farewell, Nasawada. Farewell, Aragorn and Saphira. We will expect you in Ellesmira."
"Farewell,"
said Fiernan in his deep voice. He spread his wings and jumped skyward, flapping quickly to lift the weight of the 4 people on his back, helped by the strength of the 2 Eldenari Arya was taking with her. Saphira roared after him, and Fiernan replied with a trumpeted bugle before arrowing his way toward the southeast
and the distant Beor Mountains. Aragorn twisted around in his saddle and waved to Nasawada, Elva, Jormunda, and Jod. They waved in return, and Jormunda shouted, "Best of luck to the both of you!"
"Goodbye!" cried Elva.
"Goodbye!" shouted Nasawada. "Be safe!"
Aragorn replied in kind, and then he turned his back to them, unable to bear the sight any longer. Saphira crouched underneath him and sprang into the air as they began the first leg of their long, long journey. Saphira circled as she gained altitude. Below, Aragorn saw Nasawada and the others standing in a clump by the city walls, Elva holding up a small white kerchief, which fluttered in the gusts of wind from Saphira's passage. Promises, New and Old. From Illyria, Saphira flew to the nearby estate where Blodgarm and the elves under his command were packing the Eldunari for transport. The elves would ride north with the Eldunari to Duweldenvarden, and thence through the vast forest to the elven city of Silthrim, which sat upon the shore of Ardwen Lake. There the elves and the Eldunari would wait for Aragorn and Saphira to return from Vroengard. Then together they would begin their journey out of Alagaesia, following the Gaina River as it flowed eastward through the forest, and onto the plains beyond. All of them, that was, save Laufin and Uthanare, who had elected to stay behind in Duweldenvarden. The elves' decision to accompany them had surprised Aragorn, but he was grateful for it nevertheless. As Blodgarm had said, "We cannot abandon the Eldunari. They need our help, as will the younglings once they hatch." Aragorn and Saphira spent a half hour discussing the safe transport of the eggs with Blodgarm, and then Aragorn gathered up the Eldunari of Gleda, Umaroth, and several of the older dragons. He and Saphira would need their strength on Vroengard. Upon taking their leave of the elves, Saphira and Aragorn set off to the northwest, Saphira flapping at a steady, unhurried pace, compared with that of their first trip to Vroengard. As she flew, a sadness fell upon Aragorn, and for a time he felt despondent and self-pitying. Saphira, too, was sad, she because of having parted from Fearnan. But the day was bright, and the winds were calm, and their spirits soon lifted. Still a faint sense of loss coloured everything Aragorn beheld, and he gazed at the land with renewed appreciation, knowing that he would likely never see it again. Many leagues across the verdant grasslands Saphira flew, her shadow frightening the birds and the beasts below. When night came, they did not continue onward, but stopped and made camp by a rivulet that lay at the bottom of a shallow gully, and sat watching the stars turning above them, and talking of all that had been, and all that might be. Late the next day, they arrived at the Urgal village that had sprung up near the Lake Flam, where Aragorn knew they would find Nargarsvog and the Herndal, the council of dams who ruled their people. Despite Aragorn's protests, the Urgals insisted upon throwing an enormous feast for him and Saphira, so he spent the evening drinking with Garsvarg and his rams. The Urgals made a wine out of berries and tree bark that Aragorn thought was even stronger than the strongest of the dwarves' mead. Saphira enjoyed it more than he. To him, it tasted like cherries gone bad. But he drank it anyway, to please their hosts. Many of the female Urgals came up to him and Saphira, curious to meet them, as few of the Urgal women had joined in the fight against the Empire. They were somewhat slimmer than their men, but just as tall, and their horns tended to be shorter and more delicate, though still massive. With them were Urgal children, the younger ones lacking horns, the older ones with scaly nubs upon their foreheads that protruded between 1 and 5 inches. Without their horns, they looked surprisingly like humans, despite the different colour of their skin and their eyes. It was obvious that some of the children were cull, for even the younger ones towered over their compatriots, and sometimes their parents. So far as Aragorn could tell, there was no pattern that determined which parents bore cull and which did not. The parents who were cull themselves, it seemed, bore Urgals of ordinary stature just as often as giants like themselves. All that evening, Aragorn and Saphira caroused with Garsvarg, and Aragorn fell into his waking dreams while listening to an Urgal chanter recite the tale of Nar-Tukwa's victory at Stavorosk. Or so Garjvag told him, for Aragorn could understand nothing of the Urgal's tongue, other than that it made the dwarves sound as sweet as honeyed wine. In the morning, Aragorn found himself blotched with a dozen or more bruises, the result of the friendly knocks and cuffs he had received from the Cull during their feasting. His head throbbing, and his body as well, he and Saphira went with Garjvag to speak with the Heimdall. The 12 dams held court in a low, circular hut, filled with the smoke of burning juniper and cedar. The wicker doorway was barely large enough for Saphira's head, and her scales cast chips of blue light across the dark interior. The dams were exceedingly old, and several were blind and toothless. They wore robes patterned with knots similar to the woven straps that hung outside each building, and which bore the crest of the inhabitants' clan. Each of the Heimdall carried a stick carved with patterns that held no meaning for Aragorn, but which he knew were not meaningless. With Garjvag translating, Aragorn told them the first part of his plan to forestall future conflict between the Urgals and the other races, which was for the Urgals to hold games every few years, games of strength, speed, and agility. In them, the young Urgals would be able to win the glory they needed in order to mate and earn a place for themselves within their society. The games, Aragorn proposed, would be open to every race, which would also provide the Urgals a means to test themselves against those who had long been their foes. "King Oric and Queen Nasawada have already agreed to this," said Aragorn. "And Arya, who is now Queen of the Elves, is also considering it. I believe that she too will grant the games her blessing." The Heimdall consulted among themselves for several minutes. Then the oldest, a white-haired dam, whose horns had worn away to almost nothing, spoke. Garjvag again translated.
"Yours is a good idea, Fire Sword. We must speak with our clans to decide upon the best time for these contests. But this we will do."
Pleased, Aragorn bowed and thanked them. Another of the dams spoke then.
"We like this, Fire Sword, but we do not think this will stop the wars between our people. Our blood runs too hot for games alone to cool."
"And that of the dragons does not?" asked Saphira.
One of the dams touched her horns.
"We do not question the fierceness of your kind, Flame Tongue."
"I know that your blood runs hot, hotter than most," said Aragorn. "That is why I have another idea." The Heimdall listened in silence as he explained, though Garjvag stirred as if uneasy and uttered a low grunt. When Aragorn finished, the Heimdall did not speak or move for several minutes, and Aragorn began to feel uncomfortable under the unblinking stare of those who could still see. Then the rightmost Urgal shook her stick, and a pair of stone rings attached to it rattled loudly in the smoke-filled hut. She spoke slowly, the words thick and muddied, as if her tongue was swollen.
"You would do this for us, Fire Sword?"
"I would," said Aragorn, and bowed again.
"If you do, Fire Sword and Flame Tongue, then you will be the greatest friend the Urgralgra have ever had, and we will remember your names for the rest of time. We will weave them into every one of our Tolkner, and we will carve them onto our pillars, and we will teach them to our younglings when their horns bud."
"Then your answer is yes?" asked Aragorn.
"It is."
Garjvag paused, and speaking for himself, Aragorn thought, he said,
"By a sword, you do not know how much this means to my people. We will always be in your debt."
"You owe me nothing," said Aragorn. "I only wish to keep us from having to go to war." He talked with the Heimdall for a while longer, discussing the particulars of the arrangement. Then he and Saphira made their farewells and resumed their journey to Rohangard. as the rough-hewn huts of the village shrank behind them, Zephira said,
"They will make good riders."
"I hope you are right." The rest of their flight to Vlorengard Island was uneventful. They encountered no storms over the sea. The only clouds that barred their way were thin and wispy and posed no danger to them or the gulls with whom they shared the sky. Zephira landed on Vlorengard before the same half-ruined nesting house where they had stayed during their previous visit. There she waited while Aragorn walked into the forest and wandered among the dark, lichen-encrusted trees until he found several of the shadow birds he had encountered before, and after them a patch of moss infested with the hopping maggots Nasawada had told him Galbatorix called burrow grubs. Using the name of names, Aragorn gave both of the animals a proper title in the ancient language. The shadow birds he called Sundavar Blaka, and the burrow grubs Ilgrathar. The second of the two names amused him in a grim sort of way, as it meant bad hunger. Satisfied, Aragorn returned to Zephira, and they spent the night resting and talking with Gleda and the other Eldunari. At dawn, they went to the Rock of Cuthien. They spoke their true names, and the graved doors within the mossy spire opened, and Aragorn, Zephira, and the Eldunari descended to the vault below. In that deep-set cavern, lit by the lake of molten stone that lay beneath the roots of Mount Erelas, the guardian of the eggs, Gwarok, helped them place each egg into a separate casket. Then they piled the caskets near the center of the chamber, along with the 5 Eldunari who had stayed within the cavern to help protect the eggs. With Umaroth's help, Aragorn cast the same spell he had once before, and placed the eggs and hearts into a pocket of space that hung behind Zephira, where neither she nor he could touch it. Kuarok accompanied them out of the vault. The metal feet of the dragon-headed man clanged loudly against the tunnel floor as he climbed to the surface alongside them. Once they were outside, Zephira grasped Kuarok between her talons, for he was too large and heavy to sit comfortably upon her back, and she took flight, rising above the circular valley that lay in the heart of Vlorengard. Across the sea, dark and shining, flew Zephira. Then over the spine, the peaks like blades of ice and snow, and the rifts between them like rivers of shadow. She diverted north and crossed over Palancar Valley, so that she and Aragorn might have one last look at their childhood home, if only from high above. And then over the Bay of Fundor, which was scalloped with lines of foam-crested waves like so many rolling mountains. Siunon, with its steep, many-layered roofs and sculptures of dragon heads, was their next landmark of note, and soon afterward the leading edge of Duwelden Varden appeared, the pines tall and strong. Nights they spent camped by streams and ponds, the light of their fires reflecting off Kuarok's polished metal body, while frogs and insects chorused about them. In the distance, they oft-times heard the howls of hunting wolves. Once at Duwelden Varden, Zephira flew for an hour toward the center of the great forest, whereupon the elves' wards stopped her from proceeding any further. Then she landed and walked through the invisible barrier of magic, Kuarok striding alongside her, and again took flight. League after league of trees sailed by underneath them, with little variation save for clusters of deciduous trees, oaks and elms, and birch and aspen, and languorous willows, which often lined the waterways below. Past a mountain, the name of which Aragorn had forgotten, and the elven city of Ocelon, and then trackless acres of pines, each unique and yet nearly identical to its countless brethren. At last, in late evening, when both the moon and the sun hung low upon opposing horizons, Zephira arrived at Ellesmere and glided down to land amid the living buildings of the elves' largest and proudest of cities. Arya and Fearnan were waiting for them, along with Rauron and Katrina. As Zephira drew near, Fearnan reared and spread his wings, uttering a joyful roar that frightened birds into the air for a league around. Zephira answered in kind as she settled onto her hind legs and gently placed Kuarok on the ground. Aragorn unbuckled his legs and slid down off Saphira's back. Roran ran up, grasped him by the forearm, and clapped him on the shoulder, while Katrina hugged him on the other side. Laughing, Aragorn said, "Ah, stop! Let me breathe! So, how do you like Ellesmira?"
"It's beautiful," said Katrina, smiling.
"I thought you were exaggerating," said Roran, "but it's every bit as impressive as you said. The hall we've been staying in..."
"Teal Dari Hall," said Katrina.
Roran nodded.
"That. It's given me some ideas as to how we should rebuild Carvajal. And then there's Trondheim and Farthen Dur."
He shook his head and uttered a low whistle. Aragorn laughed again and started walking along the forest path toward the western edge of Ellesmira, they leading him. Arya joined them, looking every bit as much a queen as her mother once had.
"Well met by moonlight, Aragorn. Welcome back."
He looked at her.
"Well met indeed, Shadeslayer."
She smiled at his use of the title, and the dusk beneath the swaying trees seemed to grow brighter. Once Aragorn had removed Saphira's saddle, she and Fëanor took flight, although Aragorn knew Saphira was exhausted from their journey, and together they disappeared in the direction of the crags of Tel Nir. As they departed, Aragorn heard Fëanor say,
"I caught 3 deer for you this morning. They are waiting for you on the grass by Oromis's hut."
Kuarok set off in pursuit of Saphira, for the eggs were still with her, and it was his duty to protect them. Through the great boles of the city, Roran and Katrina led Aragorn until they arrived at a clearing edged with dogwood and hollyhocks, where tables sat laden with a vast assortment of food. Many elves, garbed in their finest tunics, greeted Aragorn with soft cries, mellifluous laughter, and snatches of song and music. Arya took her place at the head of the banquet, and the white raven Blagden rested upon a carved perch nearby, croaking and spouting occasional scraps of verse. Aragorn sat by Arya's side, and they ate and drank and made merry until late in the night. When the feast began to draw to a close, Aragorn snuck away for a few minutes and ran through the darkened forest to the Manoa tree, guided more by his senses of smell and hearing than by sight. The stars appeared overhead as he emerged from beneath the angled boughs of the great pine trees. He paused then to slow his breathing and collect himself before picking his way across the bed of roots that surrounded the Manoa tree. He stopped at the base of the immense trunk and placed his hand against the creviced bark, reaching out with his mind toward the slow consciousness of the tree that had once been an elf woman. He said,
"Linnea, Linnea, awake. I must needs speak with you."
He waited, but detected no response from the tree. It was as if he were attempting to communicate with the sea or the air or the earth itself.
"Linnea, I must speak to you."
A sigh of wind seemed to pass through his mind, and he felt a thought faint and distant, a thought that said,
"What, O rider? Linnea, when last I was here, I said that I would give you whatever you wanted in exchange for the bright steel under your roots. I am about to leave Alagazia, so I have come to fulfill my obligation ere I go. What would you have of me, Linnea?"
The Manoa tree did not answer, but its branches stirred slightly. Needles fell pattering onto the roots about the clearing, and a sense of amusement emanated from its consciousness.
"Go,"
whispered the voice, and then the tree withdrew from Aragorn's mind. He stood where he was for another few minutes, calling her name, but the tree refused to respond. In the end, Aragorn left, feeling as if the matter was still unsettled, although the Manoa tree obviously thought otherwise. The next 3 days, Aragorn spent reading books and scrolls, many of which had come from Galbatorix's library, and which Vanna had sent onward to Ellesmira at Aragorn's request. In the evenings, he dined with Roran, Katrina, and Arya, but otherwise he kept to himself, and did not see even Saphira, for she remained with Fëanor on the crags of Tel Nir,
and showed little interest in anything else. At night, the roars and bellows of the dragons often echoed across the forest, distracting him from his studies and making him smile when he touched Saphira's thoughts. He missed Saphira's companionship, but he knew that she had only a short time to spend with Fionnuala, and he begrudged her not her happiness. On the fourth day, when he had learned all he could from his reading, he went to Arya and presented his plan to her and her advisers. It took him the better part of the day to convince them that what he had in mind was necessary, and moreover, that it would work. Once he had, they broke to eat. As dusk began to creep across the land, they assembled in the clearing around the Minoa tree. He, Saphira and Fionnuala, Arya, 30 of the elves' oldest and most accomplished spellcasters, Glaeda and the other Eldunari that Aragorn and Saphira had brought with them, and the two caretakers, the elf women, Iduna and Nea, who were the living embodiment of the pact between the dragons and the riders. The caretakers disrobed, and in accordance with the ancient rituals, Aragorn and the others began to sing. And as they sang, Iduna and Nea danced, moving together, so that the dragon tattooed across them seemed to become a single, unified creature. At the height of the song, the dragon shimmered, and then it opened its jaws and stretched its wings and leaped forward, pulling itself off the elf's skin and rising above the clearing, until only its tail remained touching the intertwined caretakers. Aragorn called to the glowing creature, and when he had its attention, he explained to it what he wanted, and asked if the dragons would agree.
"Do as you will, Kingkiller,"
said the spectral creature.
"If it will help ensure peace throughout Alagasia, we do not object."
Then Aragorn read from one of the books of the riders, and he spoke the name of the ancient language in his mind. The elves and the dragons who were present lent him the strength of their bodies, and the energy from them coursed through him like a great whirling tempest. With it, Aragorn cast the spell he had spent days perfecting, a spell such as had not been cast for hundreds of years, an enchantment like unto the great old magics that ran deep within the veins of the earth and the bones of the mountains. With it, he dared to do what had been done only once before. With it, he forged a new compact between the dragons and the riders. He bound not just the elves and the humans to the dragons, but also the dwarves and the urgles, making it so that any one of them could become a rider. As he spoke the final words of the mighty enchantment, and thus sealed it into place, a tremor seemed to run through the air and the earth. He felt as if everything around them, and everything in the world, perhaps, had shifted ever so slightly. The spell exhausted him, Saphira, and the other dragons. But upon its conclusion, a sense of elation filled him, and he knew that he had accomplished a great good. The greatest, perhaps, of his entire life. Arya insisted on throwing another feast to mark the occasion. Tired though he was, Aragorn participated with good cheer, happy to enjoy her company, and that of Roran, Katrina, and Ismira. In the midst of the feast, however, the food and music suddenly became too much for him, and he excused himself from the table where he sat with Arya.
"Are you all right?"
asked Saphira, looking over from her place by Fionnuala. He smiled at her from across the clearing.
"I just need some quiet. I'll be back soon."
He slipped away and walked slowly among the pines, breathing deeply of the cool night air. 100 feet from where the tables lay, Aragorn saw a thin, high-shouldered elf man sitting against a massive root, his back to the nearby celebration. Aragorn altered his path to avoid disturbing him, but as he did so, he caught a glimpse of the elf's face. It was no elf at all, but the butcher Sloane. Aragorn stopped, caught by surprise. In all that had gone on, he had forgotten that Sloane, Katrina's father, was in Ellesmere. He hesitated for a moment, debating, and then with quiet steps walked over to him. as he had the last time Aragorn had seen him. Sloane wore a thin black strip of cloth tied around his head, covering the empty sockets where his eyes had once been. Tears seeped out from under the cloth, and his brow was furrowed, and his lean hands clenched. The butcher heard Aragorn approach, for he turned his head in Aragorn's direction and said,
"Who goes there? Is that you, Adderi? I told you, I need no help."
His words were bitter and angry, but there was also grief in them, such as Aragorn had not heard from him before. "It's me, Aragorn," he said. Sloane stiffened, as if touched with a red-hot brand.
"You? Have you come to gloat at my misery, then?"
"No, of course not," said Aragorn, appalled by the thought. He dropped into a crouch several feet away.
"Forgive me if I don't believe you. It's often hard to tell if you're trying to help or hurt a person."
"That depends on your point of view." Sloane's upper lip curled.
"Now there's a weaselly elf answer if ever I heard one."
Behind him, the elves struck up a new song on lute and pipe, and a burst of laughter floated toward Aragorn and Sloane from the party. The butcher motioned over his shoulder with his chin.
"I can hear her."
Fresh tears rolled out from under the strip of cloth.
"I can hear her, but I can't see her, and your blasted spell won't let me talk to her."
Aragorn remained silent, unsure what to say. Sloane leaned his head against the root, and the knob in his throat bobbed.
"The elves tell me that the child, Ismira, is strong and healthy."
"She is. She's the strongest, loudest baby I know. She'll make a fine woman."
"That's good.
How have you spent your days? Have you kept up with your carving?"
"The elves keep you informed of my activities, do they?"
As Aragorn tried to decide how to answer, he did not want Sloane to know he had visited him once before. The butcher said,
"I guessed as much. How do you think I spend my days? I spend them in darkness, as I have ever since Helgrind, with nothing to do but twiddle my thumbs, while the elves pester me about this and that and never give me a moment's peace."
Again, laughter sounded behind them. Within it, Aragorn could make out the sound of Katrina's voice. A fierce scowl contorted Sloane's face.
"And then you had to go and bring her to Ellesmira. It wasn't enough just to exile me, was it? No, you had to torture me with the knowledge that my only child and grandchild are here, and that I'll never be able to see them, much less meet them."
Sloane bared his teeth, and he looked as if he might spring forward at Aragorn.
"You're a right heartless bastard, you are."
"I have too many hearts," said Aragorn, though he knew the butcher would not understand.
"Nah."
Aragorn hesitated. It seemed kinder to let Sloane believe that Aragorn had meant to hurt him, rather than to tell him that his pain was merely the result of Aragorn's forgetfulness. The butcher turned his head away, and more tears rolled down his cheeks.
"Go," he said, "leave me, and never trouble me again, Aragorn, or I swear one of us will die."
Aragorn poked at the needles on the ground. Then he stood and stared down at Sloane. He did not want to leave. What he had done to Sloane by bringing Katrina to Ellesmere felt wrong and cruel. Guilt gnawed at Aragorn, growing stronger second by second, until at last he reached a decision, whereupon calm settled over him again. Speaking no louder than a whisper, he used the name of the ancient language to alter the spells he had placed on Sloane. It took him over a minute, and as he neared the end of his incantations, Sloane growled between clenched teeth.
"Stop your accursed muttering, Aragorn, and be gone! Leave me, blast you, leave me!"
Aragorn did not leave, however, but began a new spell. He drew upon the knowledge of the Eldunari and of the riders whom many of the older dragons had been paired with, and he sang a spell that nurtured and fostered and restored what had once been. It was a difficult task, but Aragorn's skill was greater than it had once been, and he was able to accomplish what he wished. As Aragorn sang, Sloane twitched, and then he began to curse and scratch with both hands at his cheek and brow, as if an itch had seized him.
"Blast you! What are you doing to me?"
Ending his incantation, Aragorn squatted back down and gently removed the strip of cloth around Sloane's head. Sloane hissed as he felt the strip being pulled away, and he reached up to stop Aragorn, but was too slow, and his hands closed on empty air.
"You would take my dignity as well?" said Sloane, hate in his voice.
"No," said Aragorn. "I would give it back. Open your eyes." The butcher hesitated.
"No, I can't. You're trying to trick me."
"When have I ever done that? Open your eyes, Sloane, and look upon your daughter and granddaughter." Sloane trembled, and then, slowly, ever so slowly, his eyelids crept upward and revealed, instead of empty sockets, a pair of gleaming eyes. Unlike those he had been born with, Sloane's new eyes were blue as the noonday sky and of startling brilliance. Sloane blinked, his pupils shrinking as they adjusted to the meagre light within the forest. Then he jolted upright and twisted to peer over the top of the root at the festivities taking place between the trees beyond. The glow from the elves' flameless lanterns lit his face with a warm light, and by it he seemed suffused with life and joy. The transformation in his expression was amazing to behold. Aragorn felt tears in his own eyes as he watched the older man. Sloane continued to stare over the root like a parched traveller seeing a great river before him. In a hoarse voice, he said,
"She's beautiful. They're both so beautiful."
Another burst of laughter rang forth.
"Oh, she looks happy. And Roran too."
"From now on, you can look at them if you want," said Aragorn. "But the spells upon you still won't let you talk with them, or show yourself to them, or contact them in any way. And if you try, I'll know."
"I understand," murmured Sloane. He turned, and his eyes focused on Aragorn with unsettling force.
His jaw worked up and down for a few seconds as if he were chewing on something, and then he said,
"Thank you."
Aragorn nodded and stood. "Goodbye, Sloane. You'll not see me again, I promise."
"Goodbye, Aragorn."
And the butcher twisted round to gaze once more into the light of the elven feast.